It's for E13 of Fanacek. This is a different kind of episode. This one, I did not do the research for. I didn't write. This is going to be kind of me figuring some stuff out in real time, going through my IMDb. I thought this might be fun because you don't know what we'll stumble across here. And also, if you wanted to follow along, if you wanted to pull out your phone or sit at your laptop and pull up the IMDb application into our website, you could follow along with me, or you can just sit back and enjoy. But this was inspired back when I was doing Dick Sargent. So I was doing the Dick Sargent Beyond Bewitched episode a few weeks back, and I came across, you know, he did a series of movies with this writer director named Paul Leder. And this guy does some seriously low budget shit, really awful stuff. And look, there's lots of, you know, directors of shitty movies. I mean, Ed Wood probably being the most famous, right? But something about this guy caught me in a particular movie he did called Ape, which I went so far as to buy the poster of Ape on eBay because it was so fascinating to me. And we will talk about Ape. But I've been thinking about this guy and looking into his movies, and I thought, you know what? I'm just going to hop on the microphone, fire up the computer, and just do an impromptu episode on Paul Leder. So let's go ahead and do Paul Leder. That is L-E-D-E-R. He was born in 1926, March 25th to be exact. He died at age 70 in April 9th, 1996. Although I'm sure his family was upset, the film world probably was not. So this guy directed 22 movies, most of which he wrote. We're just going to go in order. So his first one was 1970. It was called Marigold Man, right? And here's why it's important, because this is where we start to see some of the actors that he works with a lot. But this one was written by William Norton, directed by Paul Leder. Who was William Norton? Let's see what else this fucking guy wrote. Oh, I see. Oh, he wrote Big Bad Mama. How about that? I've talked about Big Bad Mama. That's Sally Kellerman, right? Let's take a look here. Hold on. Big Bad Mama. Was that Sally Kellerman in the lead on that? Oh, Angie Dickinson. I always get them confused. But Big Bad Mama was kind of a big deal. Angie Dickinson, William Shatner, Tom Skerritt. So that's who William Norton is. What else has William Norton directed? Night of the Juggler. Day of the Animal. White Lightning. Oh, White Lightning. The Burt Reynolds movie. This guy wrote that. Okay. So William Norton's got some credits. He's got some bona fides, as they say. But Marigold Man, let's get back to that. Directed by Paul Leder, written by William Norton. Low-budget misfire concerns the farcical and dramatic situations met by two duplicitous roommates, one of whom dreams of planting a coast-to-coast garden of marigold flowers. Can't wait to not watch that movie. Now, here's why it's interesting. The star of it is Greg Mullavy, who I know nothing about. Greg Mullavy. Elaine Partnow is in it too, as well as someone named Lou Horn. But Greg Mullavy is going to come up again. I think the others will as well. This guy was the grandfather in iCarly, if you ever watched that. He was Tom Hartman in Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. So he's done some stuff. He's got some bona fides as well. Let's see. Let's take a look at Greg Mullavy. 153 acting credits. So shit, he's actually been around a lot. The last of which was iCarly. But this guy's been around. Did a lot of hit TV shows. You know, Different Strokes as I scroll through. BJ and the Bear, Trapper John. Heart to Heart. So he's done a lot. 9 to 5, the TV show. I did a whole episode about that. Cagney and Lacey. Okay, so this guy's got some bona fides. So that is the first movie. Now, that is Paul Leder's intro to film, some movie that no one really wanted to see, but it starred Greg Mullavy. We'll come back. Now, 2 years later, 1972, Paul Leder directs another William Norton written movie starring Greg Mullavy as well as others. And here's, it's called Poor Albert and Little Annie. Poor Albert. Here's the synopsis. Albert tried to kill his rich, snobby mother once. Then he was institutionalized. Now he's escaped. Albert is after his mother again, and he will torture and kill anything that lays in the way. Dun, dun, dun. Actually kind of has a cool poster. Don't open that door. Albert may be there. Albert hated women. It started with his mother. Albert got a knife. Poor women. Poor Albert. Oh, it starts early. This guy, I think by his second movie, is like, ah, fuck it. I'll just do shitty movies, right? Francis Ford Coppola, I will not be. So this one, again, Greg Mullavy plays a detective in it. Elaine Partnow is back. So those are two of the several actors that were in Marigold Man. So he's got his crew, right? So let's see if there's any trivia for this. I don't think there is. There is. Okay. Let's take a look. When this film was originally shown in theaters, patrons were given free paper upchuck cups when they purchased their tickets. Why was it that gross? Let's read a review. This person gives it 4 out of 10 stars. Well acted by Hall and atmospheric, but let down by moments of boredom. So that's the name of it. Here's the actual review. Rich kid Albert, played by Zoe Hall, is in an institute. We meet him at the beginning of the film trying to rape a nurse before he is apprehended. His doctor tells his mother that he is a lost cause and must be moved to a hospital for the insane, where he is roommates with Michael Myers. I made that up. Okay. While being taunted by one of the male nurses there, Albert tricks him into watching one of the films he's made and ends up killing him and escaping. He arrives at his mother's house to kill her. He sees her as a whore who is not pure enough. He instead comes across her housekeeper, who he taunts and kills. Yet when he meets her 11-year-old daughter, Annie, they form a bond and Albert takes her away. For once, he has met a girl who is pure and innocent, but the only problem are his violent sexual urges. Bum, bum, bum. And again, that is poor Albert, little Annie. 1975, Paul Leiter is back with The Chinese Caper. He couldn't think of a more original title. He said, well, it involves a caper and a Chinese fella, or maybe a lady, I don't know yet. So we'll call it The Chinese Caper. This one, though, is different, folks. This one's written and directed by Paul Leiter. So now Paul Leiter's like, hey, why direct some other guy's shitty screenplay when I can crap out my own shitty screenplay? After being discharged by the Air Force, a pilot tries to make a living in Taipei. And I guess that's why it's called The Chinese Caper. Now I'm looking through the cast. Meredith McRae, Victor Bono, Jeffrey Duell. I don't really know a lot of these people. Then a lot of Asian folks, which you'd expect. But his main people are gone, so he is now working all with new people. Jeffrey Duell. Why do I know that name? What has he done? Oh, he was in Chisholm. Played Billy the Kid. That's why I know him. He did some Mission Impossible. Let's take a look here. 39 acting credits. Let's see. Jeffrey Duell. He did two episodes of Mannix, at Barnaby Jones, The Manhunter, Petrocelli, Planet of the Apes, the TV show. He did one episode of that, Marcus Welby. So this guy's got some bona fides as well. Couple episodes of Streets of San Francisco, The Magician with Bill Bixby, which, by the way, folks, my next episode is going to be about Bill Bixby. Yeah, Young the Restless. This guy's got some credits, man. And then I don't know. He just stopped working. Why did he stop working? I don't know. He's not dead, I don't think. At least he's not listed as dead. But that's Jeffrey Duell. But Meredith McRae is in this movie, The Chinese Caper, and I feel like I should know her. Who is Meredith McKay? Oh, that's why. She was on Petticoat Junction for a bunch of years. Looks like she did a lot of stuff. She did The Rockford Files. Anyway, oh, she too has 39 credits. That's weird. But that's The Chinese Caper. Let's see if there's any credits on this thing. Okay, here's a good review. Paul Leiter's made some real duds. Ever see Ape? Which again, folks, we'll get to Ape. And this is yet another of them. Victor Bono plays a heist in China, plans a heist in China, and hires a crew to pull it off. Then he rips them off. This looks like it was mostly made up on the spot to accommodate the locations, which is the only good thing about the film, although Bono seems embarrassingly amused at being in this mess. The funniest and dumbest thing about the film is the way Leiter tries to hide the fact that much of the cast is dubbed. He films the Chinese actors from the back, so we can't see their mouths moving out of sync, much the way Doris Wishman did with her El cheapo sex films of the 60s. Why, I ask? I have no idea. You can get this time waster at your local dollar store. That's probably more than Leiter's budget. Oh, man. This guy's like so early in his career, just pumping out shit. So that's 1975. So just to recap, so far we've got Marigold Man, poor Albert and little Annie, then The Chinese Caper. Now it's 1976. It's our country's bicentennial. Incidentally, it's the year I'm born, and we get Ape. Oh boy, Ape is the best. And honestly, to get the full effect of this movie, you need to pull up posters for it. You need to go into the IMDb to see the pictures I'm going to reference and the poster I'm going to reference. But Ape came out in 1976. Let's take a look here. A newly discovered 36-foot gorilla escapes from a freighter off the coast of Korea. Sound familiar? At the same time, an American actress is filming a movie in the country. Sound familiar? Chaos ensues as the ape kidnaps her and rampages through Seoul. You swap out Seoul with New York City and you have King Kong. And that's going to come up later. So this thing's got the best poster of all time. So it's this big fucking gorilla. He's got a shark in one hand. He's crushing a big ship. So he's basically standing on top of the ship that's been crushed in the water. He's got a giant shark in one hand. He's fighting this giant snake with the other hand. And then here's the poster. I'll read it to you. 10 tons of animal fury leaps from the screen. See ape defy the jaws of giant shark. Mm-hmm. Destroy a teeming city. Demolish an ocean liner. Vanquish monster reptile. This is the pièce de résistance of this poster. At the bottom it says ape. and this is no shit, not to be confused with King Kong. Not to be confused by King Kong. Oh, now you got to go to the picture. So they show IMDb has some screenshots of this movie, and it's literally a toy, like in a bathtub. So like it shows a ship that's clearly like not a real ship; it's a toy. Then you see the gorilla in the water, which is I could right now go to my local mall and get a better fucking gorilla suit than this. And then it's him holding the. It's just so fucking bad. It's like ridiculously bad. So first of all, I want to get to the cast because that's really interesting. Well, first let's read more about the movie, then I'll jump into the cast. This person gives it, here's a review. This person gives it 2 stars out of 10. Here's the title of the review. I never thought I'd be getting jealous of a 36-foot ape. Okay. Truly awful King Kong ripoff that is so bad you have to see it to believe it. The ape, said to be 36 feet tall, is just some guy in a cheap gorilla suit that the filmmakers got at a costume shop or a yard sale. This isn't even a full-body ape suit. It's got sleeves with gloves. There are several instances where you can see the skin of the guy's wrists as he moves his arms about. That's the level of quality we're talking here. That's how few beeps this movie gives. That's how many shits this movie gives. He's filmed mostly from the chest up. When they do try to show you some scale for the ape's size, they do it with cheap stuff like toy boats and crummy miniature buildings. The ape also moves in slow motion throughout the movie. Let me be clear. They didn't slow down the film. The actor in the ape suit just moved really slowly to emulate slow motion, like a kid playing make-believe. Oh, I'm going to keep reading because this is funny. It goes into the cast. Well, fuck it. I'll give it away. The cast is especially bad. This is the film debut of Joanna Kearns, the mom from Growing Pains, which is also why I wanted to talk about this movie. Her screams will haunt me for weeks. So unbelievably shrill. Be prepared to turn your volume down. Laughably, at one point, while in the palm of the ape's hands, Kearns stops screaming and says, "Be gentle with me, big guy." She returns to screaming almost immediately. Bizarre! Kearns has a romantic subplot with a very 70s-looking guy named Rod Arentz. They kiss a lot. Pretty much every time they're in the same scene, Arentz is all over her. Longtime character actor Alex Nichol plays a foul-mouthed army colonel here. I have to believe his performance is intended to be funny. It makes no sense any other way. Bruce McRae is listed as responsible for the music. He should have been arrested and charged with assault. The score is relentless and will make your ears bleed. I would normally stop, but now I'm going to keep reading. One more paragraph. As the helicopters approach the ape, he stands there and makes these wild gestures with his arms. For the life of me, it looks a lot like he's dancing. Was the guy in the ape suit inebriated? Very likely. Further evidence of this is the scene where the ape flips off the army. Yeah, the guy in the ape suit was loaded for sure. It's so terrible. There are lots of pointless scenes, such as when the ape pulls a snake off a tree and throws it, hitting the camera. This goes nowhere. It just cuts away to another scene, and when it returns to the ape, he's moved on to something else. The only reason I'm giving this a 2 instead of a 1 is because of the unintended comedy. It's one of the worst movies ever made. So bad that I had to buy this damn poster. It makes me happy. The poster makes me happy. I'm curious if there's any trivia here. I'm sure it'll be about Joanna Kearns, right? Oh, this is even better. Here's the first trivia. This film was originally shot in 3D. So you can see the fucking guy's gloves in 3D. This film was listed among the 100 most enjoyably bad movies ever made. Well, I'd like to watch it. I actually looked quickly how to get it. It seems like a real fucking hassle. I can get it in like in some international formats. It'll cost me money and I don't want to do that. And I don't know. If I could find an easy VHS copy, I'd get it. Of course, then I'd have to fucking hook up a VCR. Here's more trivia. The camera shown being used on the set of the martial arts film is equipped with a Space Vision 3D lens, the same piece of equipment that was used to shoot this film. Okay, that's not terribly interesting. Here we go. The makers of the film hoped to cash in on the Dino De Laurentiis remake of King Kong 1976, which makes sense because in 76, obviously, like our, you know, King Kong had been made in like over 40 years, right? So in 76, they came out with that version of it, which was, I haven't looked it up. Jeff Bridges and, oh God, she's so beautiful. What's her name? Model turned actress. Jessica. Shit. Now I gotta look up King Kong from 1976. Damn it. King Kong, 1976. Jessica, why can't I think of her name? She's an Oscar winner too, eventually. So hold on. Jessica, this is embarrassing. Not Jessica Chastain. She probably wasn't even born. And not Jessica Tandy, because that's not sexy. Let me pause the podcast here. Well, damn it to hell, it was Jessica Lange. She won an Oscar for, forget what that movie was called. Blue Sky? Yeah, Blue Sky with Tommy Lee Jones. She won an Oscar for that, but really, really beautiful. So while we're looking at it, here's the 1976 version of King Kong. It's Jeff Bridges, Charles Grodin, Jessica Lange, John Randolph, for all you Christmas Vacation fans. He's Clark W. Griswold's dad. Rene Auberjonet, I don't know how to pronounce his name. He's a dude from MASH. He's come up before on the podcast. Ed Lauder was in this, famous character actor Ed Lauder. He's been in a million fucking things. I really loved that 1976 version. So that was my introduction to King Kong. I have since seen the 1933 version, of course. That's like the first one, kind of the classic one. But my intro to King Kong was the 1976 version. I never did see the 2005, like with Jack Black. And then they made King Kong Skull Island. I never saw that one either. But let's get back to Paul later. I remember just being a kid and the 76 King Kong was on TV. And, oh, it was such a big deal for me. I remember it was like, we were eating dinner and I like rushed through eating dinner, like at a commercial break. So I get back there and watch the movie because it was on, you know, we couldn't record it. Didn't have a decent VCR. Let me go back to this guy's filmography. Let's get back to Ape because there's more I want to talk about with Ape. So of course, the big thing with Ape that you're always going to find when talking about this movie, and one of the many things that drew me to it was the fact that, like, what the fuck is Joanna Kearns doing this? So she's not billed as Joanna Kearns in the movie. She's billed as Joanna de Verona, which I guess is her birth name. Let's look her up. I mean, she's most famous, of course. She ended up really becoming like a pretty solid TV director. But of course, like the review said, or like the trivia said, whatever it was, she was a mom in Growing Pains. So famously, she was Maggie Seaver, right? Carol Seaver was the other, was the daughter. But yeah, I was like, what the hell is Joanna Kearns doing in this movie? This was her first film, man. So how about that? So she was Joanna de Corona or de Verona. Alex Nichol was in this. We mentioned him. I'm trying to see if any of the old school actors that Paul later worked with were in it. They were not. Now this had two writers. It was written by him and Ruben, which I guess is his son. So there you go. And Ruben later has had a big career too, apparently. So that is Ape. Do yourself a favor. Look it up. Look at the poster. Look at the pictures. Now, later that year, this is his first two-year movie for Paul later, because then he did My Friends Need Killing. That's right. My Friends Need Killing. A Vietnam veteran goes on a crime spree and starts torturing and killing men he served in the army with. Now, Greg Mulvaney is back. So Greg Mulvaney is one of the leads. Meredith McRae is back. She's one of the leads. Elaine Partno is back. She's one of the leads. And he's added a few new people to it. No one of note. Again, this one, like Ape, was written and directed by Paul later. He is a fucking double threat. Triple threat, too, because I'm sure he produces this bullshit. Let's take a look at the trivia. The original title for the film was Echo of a Massacre. Echo of a Massacre. My Friends Need Killing. Now, it's got a good-looking box, but I can't read it. Hold on. I can look at the back of the box. So this is the back of the VHS box. An embittered war veteran turns executioner in this very tense, exceedingly savage thriller as he tries to salve his own conscience and erase the ever-recurring nightmares of the horrors inflicted on defenseless Vietnamese villagers. Fired by a psychopathic hatred, the American soldier stalks his former comrades, on whom he delivers a bloody revenge until there is but one survivor left. Shattering climax. Ooh, shattering climax, huh? I wonder if they're thinking about the kind of shattering climax I'm thinking about. Oh boy, there's no trivia for this, I'm sure. No, I already read it. Echo of a Massacre. Very, very interesting. All right. So that's 1976 for Paul later. And now someone out there is like, man, give this guy some more fucking money. We need more Paul later films. Because then he shits out Red Light in the White House. Red Light in the White House, 1977. A reporter digs into the background of a young woman who is running for the U.S. Senate and finds out a lot more than he bargained for. This stars Karen Collison. Don't know her. Jennifer Rhodes. Looks familiar. Let's look her up. Jennifer Rhodes. Oh, Heather's, Charmed, Grey's Anatomy, Third Rock, NCIS. So she's a character actor. She's been around. No one else of note. Written and directed by Paul later. Red Light in the White House. But what do we find about her? So here's a picture. It's like a, looks like a movie poster here. The story the National Enquirer couldn't print. You've heard the whispered rumors. Now, Susan Shawn bears all. She seduced her way from the party circuits of Beverly Hills to the master bedroom at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Wow, the expose that shocked the nation. Red Light in the White House. All right, Bill Clinton would have been all over that. Let's take a look. Is there any trivia? No trivia. Let's read a review. What do you say? Low-budget sleaze given a surprising amount of class. Oh, this person might enjoy this movie. A reporter is hired to dig up dirt on a woman running for political office. He interviews a number of associates of the woman, who each tell sleazy stories of the woman, shown in flashback in various sexual situations. So it's sexploitation, I'm guessing. Sounds like an easy excuse to show abundant nudity and sex. That's what I was thinking, doesn't it? And yes, there is plenty of that on display here, but surprisingly, it's all handled with much more seriousness than you'd think. A couple of the sex scenes, for one thing, are not treated as fun and really emphasize the great struggle the heroine went through during her life. Who the fuck wrote this? Like, someone's taking this movie seriously? The other situation she gets into may sound like the ingredients for camper sleaze. Marriage to a gay movie star, a lesbian relationship, but they are actually handled with some restraint. Even the characters are depicted as real people, talking the way people do in real life. While the dialogue would never beat David Mamet, that's for sure, it still more than beats that found in your typical cheap sexploitation movie. God, if this isn't cheap sexploitation, I don't know what the fuck is. There are a few individual lines that are witty or otherwise memorable. The acting by all the players is surprisingly good. While the direction overall isn't terribly special, it does do the job. There's one standout sequence I must admit and point out, the entire boxing ring sequence that does deliver, well, a knockout punch. I'm telling you, motherfucking Paul Lehner wrote that review, or someone who cares about him deeply, because there's no way this movie even comes close to being that fucking compelling. But let's move into 1978 and Sketches of a Strangler. Oh, this guy's got the best. So who wrote? Is it written? It is. It's written and directed by Paul Lehner. Meredith McRae is back. Meredith McRae. Jennifer Rhodes is back. Elaine Partno is back. This is one loyal motherfucker, and they're more loyal to him too. No one else of note. Again, written and directed. It is Sketches of a Strangler. I'm going to give you the synopsis, because that's what you come here for. An art student living with his sister is actually a maniac strangling dancers and prostitutes. One victim's sister starts looking for him. Well, all right. It's got a decent poster. Let's see if there's any trivia. No trivia. There's one review. I'll read the beginning of the review. Let's see. This person gives it a 5 out of 10. Decent serial killer B-movie with exceptional performances. Who the fuck says that? How can this movie have exceptional performances? Okay. Unemployed art student in Hollywood, living with his religious fanatic sister as if she were his mother, finds a release from his demons by strangulating sexually aggressive women. Writer, producer, director, editor, Paul Lehner loves narrative. There are several interesting subplots spinning around in this low-budget thriller, which has gummy cinematography and melodramatic scoring, but is otherwise fairly tight. I'm done. These reviews are written by fucking friends of his, man. That's for sure. But now, from 78 to 83, it doesn't do anything. I mean, can you believe there was 5 years where we, the fans, were being deprived of Paul Lehner films, but then 1983 we get I'm Going to Be Famous. And this is key because I've talked about on the podcast before. This seems to start the working relationship between Paul Lehner and Mr. Dick Sargent. How about that? So I've read this synopsis before. I will do it again. Again, it's my I'm Going to Be Famous. A group of young actors audition for a play by a famous author starring in a famous star. These hopefuls have every weapon available to achieve their goal, including blackmail, sex, and moita. Ooh. Hobby is... All right, so again, stars Dick Sargent as the director. Meredith McRae is back. Greg Mulvaney is back. We've got some new players in the house, though. No one of note. Jennifer Rhodes is back. I'm trying to think. I just like to see a future star. Because, like, Dick Sargent is by far the biggest fucking person he's ever worked with. The review gave it 2 out of 10 stars. Thank God we finally have a good review. Let's take a look at the trivia. No, nothing interesting here. 2-star review. Why not? Probably best known for his wonderfully retitled exploitation opus, I Dismember Mama, which we'll get to, I Dismember Mama. Paul Lehner is a directorial figure whose dubious talent leaves him not exactly awaiting rediscovery. Still, Code Red gave him a go with a tape source doubleheader featuring the equally well... What is this guy talking about? Kind of a poor man's Nashville. Okay, so I'm skipping to the next paragraph. So Nashville was the 1972 Robert Altman film about a bunch of aspiring country people. I shouldn't say they're all aspiring country artists, but they're all kind of in that country music world in Nashville. Again, 1972, Robert Altman. So that's what this person's referencing. Kind of a poor man's Nashville. Famous, God help us, is seemingly trying to be a legitimate expose on the day-to-day lives and loves of a small group of Hollywood hopefuls looking to land the male lead in a new Broadway play. Why exactly it's casting in LA before moving to New York is never specified, Is this common practice? It is not. The director, Dick Sargent, is of course schmoozing all the young leads, while the female star, herself the daughter of a famous Hollywood actress driven to drink by the expectation that carries, is simply trying to stay afloat and while maintaining her singing career. I'm not that interested. All right. So it is now 1984, and we have a new Paul Leder film, and it is called Vultures. Great box. Okay, but here's the synopsis for Vultures. A dying, wealthy patriarch, Ramon, summons his relatives to his bedside, setting the tone for intriguing suspense when a bizarre set of murders occurs. The terror begins with the arrival of the old man's sister and her lover. Blood and gore are a regular state of affairs. The first suspect is Carl, who, despite his protests of his innocence, is hounded by the local detective. But the morbid killings continue. So is he the murderer, or isn't he? And I'll never know. Because I'll never watch this pile of shit. But it's got a pretty decent looking box. Of course, it stars Aldo Reyes in this, which we'll get to. But everything's in another language, so it's probably distributed overseas. Just again, another reason why fucking international people don't like Americans, because they see our shit movies. Stuart Whitman is one of the leads. Yvonne DiCarlo is in this. She's pretty big now. Yvonne DiCarlo. She was Yvonne DiCarlo. Was she Lillian Munster? I'm like 99% sure. I always get her in the Addams Family chick. Fucking confused. Which one is this one? Yvonne DiCarlo, I think, is Lillian Munster. Am I wrong? Am I crazy? Who played Lillian Munster? Now I got to scroll. And you have to listen to me scroll. Yes, she was Lily Munster. Not Lillian Munster. Lily Munster. Maybe all of us Lillian and shortened to Lily. I don't know. But Yvonne DiCarlo is in this movie. Aldo Ray is in this. Okay, I'm going to come back to Aldo Ray. But let me go first. Greg Mulvey is back. Meredith McRae is back. We got some new players in the house. No one of note. Again, written and directed by Paul Leder. And then there's Aldo Ray. So Aldo Ray, I've talked about this on the podcast multiple times. Pretty prolific actor. Had a big career, really in the 50s and 60s. He's got a whole chapter about him in the novelization of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Basically, if you like the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the novel is completely different. So it's really interesting. There's some things in the movie, basically the murders at the end of the movie, are basically mentioned in like one sentence of the book. That's it. It's like just, it was mentioned in passing. So very, very different stuff. But there's an entire chapter about Cliff Booth being somewhere overseas. I want to say South America or maybe the Philippines or something like that. Working on a film, and Aldo Ray is there, and they basically hang out in a hotel room together and drink because Cliff Booth is a big fan of Aldo Ray. So I thought that was kind of neat. So Quentin Tarantino must be a big fan of Aldo Ray as well. So Aldo Ray is in this Vultures movie. Like I said, some of the people are back. No big names in this besides really Yvonne DiCarlo and Aldo Ray. I don't see any trivia, but it's got a good review here. So this person gives it a 7 out of 10. 80s camp horror all the way. Fans of campy bad horror films will love this one. Jim Bailey was one of the original and better female impersonators during the 70s and 80s. He has a field day playing several different roles, including a female impersonator doing Barbra Streisand in a horror movie. A rather plump Yvonne DiCarlo. Wow. She got called out for gaining weight, huh? A rather plump Yvonne DiCarlo hams it up and has the best line in the movie, laying in bed next to a gigolo, "Shut up, I can't think and fuck at the same time." Well, there you go. The film is not taken seriously by anybody, just like every other piece of shit Paul Leder's ever made. So I'm cutting that review off. Don't like it. 1986, The 11th Commandment, and this is big because Dick Sargent is back, as is Greg Mulvey. He's back. Who else is back? Any of the regulars back? Jennifer Rhodes is back. So he's got a crew, a pretty dedicated crew. The 11th Commandment, a young man driven to insanity by his corrupt uncle breaks out of a mental hospital and proceeds to kill his way through in order to save his 9-year-old cousin from her corrupt family and avenge his father's killing. That was convoluted. And I kind of lost interest halfway through. Bernard White is the lead. Looks pretty familiar to me. He's in the Matrix, all the Matrix movies, which I've only seen the first one. It really wasn't for me. Who's in that miniseries Beef about the two Asian people who had road rage? Again, Dick Sargent, Greg Mulvey's back. I saw something here that was interesting to me, though. Oh, James Avery's in this. James Avery, he played Uncle Phil in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. He was also the voice of is it Shredder? The bad guy in the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle cartoons. Julia Campbell's in this. Julia Campbell had a career in the 90s. She was kind of, yeah, she's basically a character actor. I really remember her as one of the mean bitches in Romy Michelle's High School Reunion. A very underrated movie. I always liked that movie. And Julia Campbell was in it kind of playing an asshole. But again, she popped up a lot in 90s films. And I've not really seen her since. She never quite clicked. But that is 1986, The 11th Commandment. Now, 1986, just like 1976, is a two-movie year for Paul Leder. And you know what? I'm actually, for a normal director, I'd say that's a lot, two movies in a year, you know? But for a guy who clearly only spends about 4 to 11 days making each movie he fucking directs, you think he'd pump out about 16 movies a year, because quite frankly, they're not that great. I didn't check. The 11th Commandment, it was, Paul Leder, but it was based on a story by William Norton. Paul Leder wrote the screenplay, but it's based on a story by William Norton. If you recall, William Norton wrote Paul Leder's first two films. So it's a whole circle of mediocrity that we've got here. They're all very loyal to each other. 1989 now, Murder by Numbers. Now, there was a great movie called Murder by Numbers. I think it was in 2002. Sandra Bullock in the lead. Michael Pitt was in it. He was great. But that's the movie that really gave us Ryan Gosling. That was like the, okay, now he's a household name. He stole the movie, basically. And then from that movie, started dating Sandra Bullock, which I don't think a lot of people knew. She, at the time, was like in... she was probably about 40 or close to it. And he was like 21, 22. And he dated her. And they went to the premiere together holding hands. And I was like, look at this little guy, 22 years old, pulling it down, Sandra Bullock. And he ended up being Ryan Gosling. Pretty legit. Murder by Numbers, 1989. You want a synopsis? I'm going to give you a synopsis. Hired by the deceased's ex-wife, a private eye checks out the death of a gay man who had AIDS. So why'd she hire him then? Like, he died of AIDS. I'm hiring a private detective to find the AIDS that killed him. That's funny. That would actually be a funnier synopsis. Like, I've been hired to find some AIDS. Sherry Belafonte is in this. She's a kind of a big name. Ronnie Blakely's in this. She's a character actor as well. Don't see anything else. Cleavon Little. Oh, Cleavon Little was in this. He was, the black guy in Blazing Saddles. Yes, yes, yes. Dick Sargent. God, Dick Sargent, why are you in this? Written and directed by Paul Leder. Oh, boy, Paul Leder. Let's take a look here. Is there a trivia? These movies just don't have any trivia. That makes me sad. All right, we're moving on. Now it's 1990. Going to Chicago. Oh, another two movie year. Going to Chicago. The story of a group of collegiate friends who are all committed to the liberal movement supporting Democratic Party candidate Eugene McCarthy during the 1968 U.S. presidential campaign. Now, here's why this is interesting to me. So Paul Leder directed it. Did he write it? He also wrote it. Now, we've already established this guy's a shitty, shitty director, writes shitty movies, got no budget. I mean, these things are laughable. I would love to see what a period piece looks like for this guy. Like, he made this in 1990. It's supposed to take place in 68. I'd love to see what the cars in this movie look like, the wardrobe. I bet it's pretty bad. But guess who one of the leads is? Cleavon Little. So now Cleavon Little got roped into this guy's mediocrity. Gary Kroger's in this. Why do I know Gary Kroger? That is a very... Oh, that's right. He was on SNL for a few years in the early 80s. Like the shitty when Lorne Michaels was gone years. That's why I know that name. Okay. I think he's from Second City too. Maybe not. Anyway, I know Gary Kroger. It's so funny. Who else is in this? No one I know. No one. Let's see if any of his regulars. No, none of his regulars. Except for Cleavon Little, who's now done two movies with him. That's interesting. I'm guessing we won't have any trivia for this. Oh, there is one trivia. It's Cleavon Little's last film. How about that? Cleavon Little, the guy who basically stole Blazing Saddles. He was so funny. Where are the white women at? That's one of my favorite lines. I always wanted to get a t-shirt that says that. Where are the white women at? But it sounds funnier than I think it would be. I'd probably end up getting punched in the face. All right. Let's take a look. Should I read a review? You know what? It's Cleavon Little's last film. Why don't I read a review? There are no reviews. So there you go. You've been robbed, folks. But again, 1990, two movie year for Paul Leder. So the next one is $20 Star. It should be called $20 Movie. Oh, a successful Hollywood actress by day prowls the streets at night as a sex worker. She must be fucking pulling it down as a sex worker. And here's why I say that. Like, you can make millions and millions as a successful Hollywood actress, right? We'll use one as a, who's a, Jennifer Lawrence right now is a very successful Hollywood actress. She probably makes what, $10 to $12 million per film. However, what would she make if she were a prostitute? Dude, all of us would sell our homes, fucking sell our cars. She could be easily making six, seven figures a night as a prostitute. So anyway, my point is this lady must be wealthy. I'm going to read that synopsis again. 1990, $20 star. I hope that's what she's charging, because that's, she's, you know, not valuing herself. A successful Hollywood actress by day prowls the streets at night as a sex worker. Stars Rebecca Holden, Bernard White, he's back. Who else? Dick Sargent. Why are you in this, man? Come on, Dick Sargent. Yeah, a couple of familiar faces. Jennifer Rhodes is back. Greg Mulvaney's back. That fucking guy's got it better to do. There's a name here, J.D. Lewis. I've seen a few times. He's back. This is written and directed by Paul Leder. Poor Paul Leder. There's no reviews for this, though, so I shall move on. Now, 1991, Frame Up. I think I've read about this before on the podcast. In the small American town of Wharton Creek, David Farmer is accidentally killed by Don Curran, son of town tyrant Will Curran, during a fraternity initiation. The frat boys frame electronic parts salesman Frank Govers for hit and run, but determined newcomer Sheriff Ralph Baker and his love interest Joe Westlake seek the truth. Govers and girlfriend Leanne Hadley hide in a hunting cabin and are captured by prison escapees Mick August and Merlin Wells. How can they literally name any more fucking people in this review? Like, I'm already fucking confused. August tries to claim the bounty on Govers from Will Curran, but none of this means anything to me because I don't even know who these fucking people are. Skip it. Wings Hauser is the lead. Wings Hauser, man. I like Wings Hauser. He was in The Insider. Let's take a look here. Wings Hauser, yeah, he was Dylan McKay's, no, that's not true. Dylan McKay hired him to like find his missing sister, I think, at 90210. There was a South American like jungle episode of 90210, because as you know, or maybe you don't know, Dylan McKay's father was a ne'er-do-well millionaire who like faked his own death or something. Later in the show, Dylan finds out he has a sister, a little sister. She's like 12. And of course, they develop a great relationship. Then little sister gets kidnapped and brought to the jungle. Dylan hires Wings Hauser, and together they go to the jungle to rescue the sister. And by the way, so, you know, Facebook's, you know, puts reels. You know, I don't know why they think I'd like these videos. And some of them I do like. But for whatever reason, I'll go to Facebook and I'll get sucked into this rabbit hole of these reels and short video clips and stuff. And they give me a surprising amount of 90210. I don't know why. Because I'm not particularly into 90210. However, I watch 90210. But a lot of these clips are of Luke Perry and or Jason Priestley beating people up. So there was a surprising amount of Dylan and Brandon beating the shit out of people in 90210, which I find so interesting because I look at them and I'm not a tough guy by any means, but I'm pretty sure I could beat the shit out of both of them at the same time. I wouldn't even need a beer for that fight. I'd probably walk right into that one, chin up, and just fucking go for it. I'm pretty sure I could outscrap them both. So it just makes me laugh that there's such tough guys in this show. But Wings Hauser had a pretty good career, man. He's got 114 acting credits. You know, I'll just scroll down to the earlier stuff because he was kind of a big deal, man. So he did a lot of TV in the 70s. Canon, Moving On, Beretta. What else? Emergency. I love that. Magna PI. Now we're in the 80s, of course. The Fall Guy. Let's see here. Hardcastle McCormick. Magruder. Magruder and Loud? Was that real? Oh, I was thinking Magruber. I thought it was like, wow, was Magruber a real thing? And then he kind of started getting into some weird stuff. He did two episodes of The A-Team. He did Airwolf. I don't know at what point he kind of became a name. I'm trying to look here. But he certainly became a name. He had a great career as just kind of a B-movie star, like B-level shit. He was never an A-lister, and he wasn't in A-list projects for the most part. But anyway, he's been around quite a while. So let's get back to whatever the hell movie this was. Oh, Frame Up. Bobby DeCoco, or Bobby DeChicho, Wings Hauser, Heather Fairfield, Frances Fisher. How about that? Frances Fisher's been in a ton of stuff. Unforgiven, she was that prostitute with the fucked up face, remember that? Oh, no, that's not true. She hired Clint Eastwood to avenge the lady who got her face all fucked up. Titanic, she was the mom. She was Rose's mom in Titanic. Robert Picardo's in this. He's had a great career. He was on China Beach. He was also the coach in the Wonder Years. Any of the regulars? Where's Paul Leder's regulars at, man? Oh, but this was written by Ruben Leder, directed by Paul Leder. And it is Frame Up. Any trivia? Dick Sargent's last feature film. Now, isn't that fucked up? That kills me. Dick Sargent, that great career that he had, and his last movie was this pile of shit. Anyway, that is 1991's Frame Up. It's got a pretty stupid movie box. Let's see if I can scroll in and read the back of the box. Well, it's not even written in English. Yeah, a lot of Paul Leder's movies didn't get distributed here. And what's interesting, again, I worked in a mom-and-pop video store in the early 90s, so a lot of the stuff I would have seen, and I've never even heard of half these things, so they weren't even making it on the video store circuit. They were only getting distributed overseas. Now, that was 1991's Frame Up. In 1992, we get Frame Up 2, The Cover-Up. Frame Up 2, The Cover-Up. The bank president in a small California town isn't quite the upstanding citizen he appears to be. He's a corrupt killer who has just kidnapped the wife and daughter of the local sheriff. Well, goddammit, I'm a stander for that. Margot Hemingway is in the lead. Okay. Margot Hemingway is fucking beautiful. I have always loved Margot Hemingway. I've also loved Mariel Hemingway. They are the granddaughters of Ernest Hemingway. Wings Hauser's back. Cole Hauser. So Cole Hauser, I believe, is the son of Wings Hauser, if I'm not mistaken. He's had a great career, too. He's founder of... was born. He is the son. Yeah, so he is the son of Wings Hauser. Cole Hauser's been around forever. So he came out of the same acting crew as Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. In fact, he's one of the buddies both in School Ties and Good Will Hunting. So Cole Hauser's in that. He kind of struggled. He never had quite the career as his buddies did. But then, of course, he's recently hit it big with Yellowstone. I don't watch that show, but he's the fucking tough guy in Yellowstone. Apparently, all the ladies love him. But that's Cole Hauser's in this. Wings Hauser, of course. John Saxon and Patty Darbinville. Shit, Patty Darbinville. She was briefly, if I'm not mistaken, I believe at one point Patty Darbinville was married to Don Johnson. Am I making that up? She has three kids with Terry Quinn. That's interesting. Has a son with Don Johnson. Yeah, I knew that they were together. So anyway, that's Patty Darbinville. She was Patty Darbinville Quinn for a while. Who else is in this one? Frame Up 2, The Cover Up. Anything else? I mean, they've already got a pretty... Greg Mulvaney's back. Jennifer Rhodes is back. Some OG. Now, this one was not written by Ruben Leder. It was written by Paul Leder and directed by Paul Leder. And I love it because Frame Up, not that I've seen it or ever will see it or know anything about it, but my guess is Frame Up leaves you like, that was not enough. Like, that ending is not satisfying to me. Like, wow, I'm supposed to go to bed? I'm supposed to go on with my life? And he was like, no, I got you. Frame Up 2, The Cover Up. And that is Frame Up 2, The Cover Up. I'm going to read a review. I haven't done that in a while. This person gives it 5 out of 10 stars. The Tender Side of Wings, Part 2. Deadly Conspiracy, aka Frame Up 2. Oh, it's one of those movies too. It has like 18 titles. Has Wings Hauser, small town sheriff, again, romantically involved with Francis Fisher while trying to raise his young daughter. Meanwhile, John Saxon turns loose two goons who go on a murdering spree to cover up Saxon's illegal corporate dealings. Margot Hemingway, in a thankless role, plays Saxon's drug-addicted captive wife. Film annoyances abound, including elevator music, squirm-inducing attempts at humor, and sinkhole-sized plot deficiencies. Despite these faults, it is difficult not to find enjoyment in a film that features Wings Hauser and John Saxon. I would agree with that. I like Wings Hauser. For fans of the actors, Deadly Conspiracy is definitely watchable. So at some point, this was Deadly Conspiracy. Now it's Frame Up 2, Electric Boogaloo. This is always a good sign. So here's the first trivia. Production completed in 1992. It was released in 1996. That means it sat in a fucking basement for 4 years until some asshole decided to bring it out. Cole Hauser's feature film debut. So that's one of the bright spots of this thing. And that is Frame Up 2, The Cover Up. Now, 1992 was also a 2-movie year. So he gave us Frame Up 2, The Cover Up. But he also gave us Exiled in America. Is it written? Ooh, this is... Okay. It's written by Paul Leder, but based on a play by William Norton. So Paul Leder and William Norton continue to be close, right? Maxwell Caulfield is leading this. But before I go into the actors, let me go ahead and give you a synopsis so you know what the hell we're talking about. So again, this is Exiled in America from 1992. A Central American revolutionary is captured and tortured by government forces. He escapes and flees to the U.S., hiding out in a rural area where he is sheltered by a Christian sanctuary movement. His wife gets a job at a local diner run by one of the town's shadier women, and soon a CIA assassination team shows up looking for him. Wow, Exiled in America stars Maxwell Caulfield. So Maxwell Caulfield was the lead, I believe he's British, maybe Australian, the lead in Grease 2. Remember that? He like that movie was kind of flipped on its heels or flipped on its head. Instead of like a Sandy trying to get cool, it's this guy trying to get cool. I guess it would make sense that he was Australian since she was Australian, but I don't know. I always felt like he was a British actor. Wonder how I can find out. Where was this fucker born? Anyway, I'm not that interested in it. However, I did not say it's the same birthday as me, November 23rd. Isn't that interesting? Edward Albert is in this. Who else is in this? Anyone we know? Stella Stevens. Stella Stevens, man. She played a lot of hot roles in 70s movies, man. She was oftentimes like the prostitute or that kind of thing. She's done a bunch of stuff. Wings Hauser is back. Bill Cobb. So everyone knows Bill Cobb's. Great character actor. African-American. Looks like he's still alive. Born in 1934. Gosh, that makes him pretty damn old. He was in a lot of things. Great character actor. He was in That Thing You Do. I just saw him in a Six Feet Under episode. He was in a Sopranos. I think he was in a couple of Sopranos episodes, actually, as that African-American preacher that Tony Soprano's kind of working with the guy's son. Jennifer Rhodes is back. I'm trying to see here. Oh, I got some dog barking here. Hold on. Sorry, I had a quick... quick glitch there, but so as I go through the cast, Eric Hauser is in this. He's Cole Hauser's uncle. He is Wings Hauser's brother. So now it's a family affair for the Hausers working on Paul Leder films. This was, again, based on a play by William Norton, which I mentioned earlier. I'm trying to see if there's any trivia or anything like that for this. So no trivia, but there is a review for this. Let's take a look. So this review gives it 1 out of 10 stars. That's about right. Now we got a decent reviewer here. The title is Below Minimum Standards. Based upon the play Sanctuary by William Norton Sr., this film, scripted by the director Paul Leder, is not so much an adaptation as an extension with numerous plot threads overdeveloped by Leder, with an end result that Sanctuary, an underground Christian church-based movement to harbor political refugees from Central America, is jettisoned in favor of poorly defined melodramatic issues. Wow, this guy goes into real depth. I mean, this. Let's see here. The acting is cavalier, as should be expected given a weak director, with Albert quietly effective as an activist university professor attempting to contravene genocide in his nation. And there are polished turns from John Constantine and Gina Gallego, whilst Caulfield and Stevens are distressingly grating. To be fair, one must own that the origin of the flavorless performances of the latter duos is found within this scenario, an awkwardly disposed piece wherein a glut of themes and cliches beggars any attempt to focus upon one. Who wrote this review? Like, fucking Christ, who writes these things? Basically, the movie sucked and the acting sucked. That's what it should say. Oh, this is frustrating. All right, now we're in 1993, right? 30 years ago this year, and we have The Baby Doll Murders. Yikes, yikes, yikes. Written and directed by Paul Leder. Let's take a look at this synopsis. The Baby Doll Murders. Someone is killing off young women in L.A., leaving a baby doll with each of the bodies. Convinced a recently released criminal is responsible, the detective pushes hard on the ex-con, who slaps him with harassment charges. Suspended from the force, he continues investigating and finds that each of the victims were patients of a Beverly Hills doctor. Well, there it is. I bet that doctor has something to do with it. That's my guess. So it stars Jeff Kober. John Saxon is back. Let's see. A couple people are back, but no big names, which I guess should be special. Julie McCulloch is in this. Okay, so I've talked about Julie McCulloch before. She was the famous Playboy playmate who was fired by Kirk Cameron, or was forced into being fired by Kirk Cameron on Growing Pains. Of course, Joanna Kearns was also on Growing Pains, so it all comes back together. She was the star of Ape. But yeah, Julie McCulloch was great and really beautiful. And again, you know, because Kirk Cameron was a born-again Christian and all that shit, when he found out that she had been in Playboy, he called the producers of Growing Pains pornographers and forced their hand into firing her. And she had a long arc that they hadn't seen out yet. Like, it was going to be a long relationship with the character that Kirk Cameron played. But she got shit-canned and derailed her career, and I'm guessing she probably fucking hates him. And I wouldn't blame her. So that is that. So Julie McCulloch is that. No one else of note. Gosh, is there any trivia? There is some trivia. Let's take a look. No, gotten really interesting. Okay, how about a review? You guys want a review of The Baby Doll Murders? 3 out of 10 stars. Excess and poor script. This film is basically the combination of a late night slasher film with an even later night adult skin flick. Here we have an obsessed police officer, Jeff Kober, tracking down a murderer who only kills buxom women, leaving a plastic baby doll as his calling card. You need a calling card, though, right? Just like the wet bandits in Home Alone. The man he believes to be the killer has been proved innocent and let go. But that doesn't stop Kober from chasing the guy at the risk of his job and relationship with police. Secretary? Dispatcher? Melanie Smith. I don't even know what the fuck that means. A good drinking game can be played during this film. Either take a swig every time Kober bats an eyelash, which is never, or chug on the can when an actress has a topless scene, which is often. Well, call me crazy, but I'm in. Let's see, lots of violence, story, Okay. Well, that was a little bit better. Maybe I should start writing reviews instead of doing a podcast. We only have several films left, I think 4 films left. Now we're in 1994. Molly and Gina. Ooh, Molly and Gina. Ooh, some bigger names in this one. Written and directed by Paul Leder. Although there's 2 writers credited. Oh, Paul Leder and his son Ruben. Yay, Ruben. Molly and Gina. Molly is the former secretary of a murdered private detective. Gina, a budding actress, witnesses shooting which also killed her boyfriend. Together, they set out to bring the culprits to justice. And one, if not both, are taking their shirts off. I added that last part. All right, Frances Fisher is one of the leads, right? We've talked about her. Of course, Titanic, Natasha Gregson. I'm guessing Natasha Gregson Wagner? Yep. Natasha Gregson Wagner. She was Natalie Wood's daughter. So how about that? That's kind of cool. So Natalie Wood's daughter is in this movie, Fall from Grace. Stella Stevens is back. I do like her. Peter Fonda. Fuck. Peter Fonda's Elizabeth Berkley from Saved by the Bell. I love it. Who else? Anyone else? Greg Mullavy is back. That fucking guy. Can't get rid of him. He's been with Paul Leder since the beginning, y'all. A guy named Stink Fisher. So we're going to look into that. Okay, let me backtrack. First, let's go through. Peter Fonda. Holy shit. I mean, you know, Easy Rider, Jane Fonda's brother, and he's in this piece of shit, huh? Interesting. Elizabeth Berkley, so she was Jesse Spano in Saved by the Bell, of course, really blew up in fame when she made that Showgirls movie, which I'm going to say so right now, underrated movie. It's historically bad, but it's actually kind of a fun watch. But before that came out, so in between Saved by the Bell and Showgirls, I've got a funny story about Elizabeth Berkley. So I mentioned this before, during the summers in high school, I used to work as a messenger. And you know, I was only like 16 years old, like 15, 16, 17, those years. But all the grown-ups I work with basically treated me like an adult. So after work, I'd go to the bar with them and all this stuff because it was New York in the 90s. They didn't give a shit. No one checked ID. Well, one Friday, it was like the Friday before a holiday weekend. I forget what it was. And we were cutting off early. We were going to have a barbecue, basically buy a bunch of beers, barbecue. So they sent me and another messenger to go kind of start to round up some of the supplies, if you will. So, and I've already been drinking. So we'd been drinking while we were working anyway, and now I was running out to either get more beer or ice, whatever it was I was getting there in Midtown Manhattan. And me and my buddy, who I work with, are walking down the street, and we realized that it's Elizabeth Berkley walking ahead of us, right? So I'm half in the bag. I'm 16 years old, you know, give or take a year. And I start singing the theme song to Saved by the Bell. It's all right, because I'm Saved by the Bell. You know, and I keep like yelling out, hey, Jesse Spano and all this. Middle of Midtown Manhattan. I'm not kidding. It's like 51st Street, right? Fifth Avenue. She turns around. She goes, fuck you, and gives me the finger. That's the best. I'm a 16-year-old. I got Elizabeth Berkley to tell me, fuck you, and gave me the finger. Other than that, I'm sure she's a pleasant lady. I was, to be fair, as being a prick. Let's see. This is the feature film debut of Elizabeth Berkley. So there you go. It only went up from there, huh? A review? Why not? Let's see. Determined Women. All right, let's take a look. This one gives it 4 out of 10 stars. It's called Determined Women, Derivative Script. Molly and Gina is not a bad way to while away some spare time. I got an inexpensive copy through eBay because it sounded a little different. Who the fuck goes to eBay, A, not knowing what they're going to buy, reading like descriptions of movies, and then makes their purchase? Like, have you ever gone to eBay not knowing specifically what you're fucking looking for? Anyway, Molly and Gina is not a bad way to while away some spare time, apparently. I got an inexpensive copy through eBay because it sounded a little different. I don't regret the purchase, but would if I'd paid first-hand market value. What is first-hand market value for this? $11, maybe, including shipping? The lead characters, markedly different women, bereaved in the same shooting incident, are well-played and not bad company. And the damsel in distress is played by Elizabeth Berkley as someone you want to protect. Unless she yells at you on Fifth Avenue. But far too much of the script seems to have been stenciled from every L.A. noir production ever screened. All the lines we know are coming to arrive on schedule, sometimes as part of the action, sometimes within Francis Fisher's voiceovers. The audience is not much trusted. The filmmakers really seem to think it necessary to have Molly explain what a missile is. But this movie does have some brisk action and cool gunplay. I'd love to know why she has to explain what a missile is. But that's Molly and Gina. Now, also in 94, another two-year movie for Mr. Paul Leder, Killing Obsession. Dun, dun, dun. Killing Obsession, written and directed by Paul Leder. This guy don't fuck around. If he's not at the typewriter, he's behind a camera. A deranged psychopath. New territory for Paul Leder. A deranged psychopath, recently released from prison, sets out in search of Annie, the 11-year-old daughter of the woman he murdered 20 years earlier. Wants to apologize, I'm guessing. Hey, kid, you're 31 now. My bad. No one really, Eddie Barth, I mean, I know the name, no big names here. Let's take a look. This guy, Bobby DiCiccio, keeps popping up. So he does a lot of work with Paul Leder. J.D. Lewis keeps popping up. He does a lot. Beverly Mitchell's in this. She was like one of the kids in Seventh Heaven. I didn't watch Seventh Heaven because I had a life, but no Beverly Mitchell was in it. Jennifer Rhodes is back. She's an old school. John Saxon's back. She's old school. These are all people very loyal to Paul Leder. And to be fair, he's loyal to them. Let's see. Is there any trivia? No trivia. We're going to move on. That one did not look interesting. Okay. Two movies left, both in 1995. The first one, The Wacky Adventures of Dr. Boris and Nurse Shirley. I gotta take a breath before I even fucking start this. Okay. The Wacky Adventures of Dr. Boris and Nurse Shirley from 1995. A plastic surgeon and his nurse administer an aesthetic clinic that attracts several young women. There you go. But the two kill their clients and sell them to the world's richest man who has sexual perversions. All right. Paul Bartel, don't know him. I'm looking, no big names here. Karen Black. Karen Black was a big name in the 70s, man. Like, Karen Black did some good shit. Five Easy Pieces, The Great Gatsby. Nashville. I mentioned Nashville earlier, that Robert Altman movie from, 75. I guessed it at 72. She was in that. That's it. I don't know. It got a lot of Oscar buzz, that movie. I wasn't that into it when I saw it, but still, Karen Black was a very big deal in the 70s. And again, a fall from grace. Hyapatia Lee is in this. Hyapatia Lee. So I think I'm pronouncing that right. All right, I got a story about her too, but let me move on. Greg Malavia is back. All right. Del Zamora? Is he related to, no, it doesn't matter. Okay. So Hyapatia Lee. So when I was a kid, the very first porno I ever saw, it was by accident, but it was in fact Hyapatia Lee, who was getting boned in my very ever first porno that I ever set eyes on. I want to say that the movie was called, it was like an incest movie, I hate to say. Now I got to look up her movies. We should do that. Let me look up all her movies. Hyapatia Lee. I don't know if our porno's on IMDb. They are. Let's go through. Okay, I'm going to walk you through. Let's Get Physical. That's it. It's her first one. So her first movie in 1983, I'm pretty sure it was an incest movie, and it's the first porno I ever saw. So there you go. A little more about Fanchek than you wanted to know. Interesting. It's so funny. Now, this was directed by Paul Leder, not Let's Get Physical, although that would be an upgrade for him. But it was written by Liam Naughton. So look at that. This is the only writing credit he has. It's the only producing, only credit this guy has at all was he wrote and produced this fucking shitty movie. And Paul Leder directed it. Let's take a look if there's any trivia. I'm wondering if Hyapatia Lee will come back. Nope, there is no trivia, no reviews. Last movie, although there's one I want to go look up. The Killers Within. And I talked about this in the Dick Sargent podcast. Let's take a look. Did I? Maybe not, because I don't think Dick Sargent's in this. Nope, okay. The Killers Within. All right. 1995. A man must track down the reasons behind his brother's mysterious death and uncovers a secret neo-Nazi group headed by a powerful congressman. All right, stars Robert Carradine, one of the Carradine brothers. He was in Revenge of the Nerds. Meg Foster, big career for her. John Saxon's back. Mike Farrell. Look at Mike Farrell is back. I like Mike Farrell. He was on MASH. That's how I know him mostly. Ben Reed. No one of real note here. Jennifer Rhodes is back. All the normal players are back. Meredith McRae, she was from the old school. This, of course, is written by Paul Leder and directed by Paul Leder. Any reviews, any trivia? No, nothing good. Oh, Meredith McRae's final acting work. She unfortunately died at just 56 from a brain tumor 5 years later. Oh, man, that sucks. And this was the final directorial effort of Paul Leder. So that ends the Paul Leder directing. However, there was one he wrote that I think did not get mentioned, and I want to find it. I believe it was his movie. Gosh, let me scroll through. What happened to I Dismember Mama? I thought that was his. Is it not? So I'm going to I Dismember Mama. We're going to look that up on my IMDb here. I Dismember Mama. No, I'm not seeing it on IMDb. Let's search this thing out. I Dismember Mama. That's 2017, though. What would that have to do with Paul Leder? Scrolling through. I Dismember Mama. Nope. So anyway, I was wrong. That was not Paul Leder. But let's go back here. Let's get back into Paul Leder before I wrap up this podcast. So thanks for bearing with me on this one. This was very different. I thought I would just do kind of like a live me going through, just kind of exploring IMDb and Paul Leder's career as we do this. Because here's the thing, man. A lot of things, I'm eventually thinking I want to write a book. So I'm taking a lot of notes as I do this research. And I just kind of been obsessing on Paul Leder and his career and just how it's interesting how some people can be so gratuitously shitty. And on the one hand, I like making fun of it. On the other hand, I'm like, wow, this guy spent his professional life writing and directing films. It's still pretty cool. And there's some asshole like me doing a podcast about it. So I guess I'll say this, Paul Leder, I'll end it like I end everyone else's. He passed away at age 70 on April 9th, 1996, just a year after your final two movies. Thank you. You gave me some good laughs. I have an ape poster on my wall here in my home office now because it's one of the funniest things I've ever fucking seen. But you know what? You spent your life clearly doing what you love, writing, directing, producing. Your family, it turns out your son clearly is in the business as well. I think I read your daughter is in it too. So Paul Leder, you had a life well lived. Your movies are probably not top notch, but you in fact made movies. So thank you for your legacy. Thanks for listening to this. Thanks for bearing with me on this one. This was kind of an experiment. Just want to dive down the rabbit hole in this guy, Paul Leder. If you like the podcast, rate and review it. That's always helpful. You can email me. FanCheckPodcast@gmail.com. Of course, I'm on Facebook, Real FanCheck. I'm on Twitter at FanCheckPodcast. And you know what I need you to do? I need you to just go ahead and stay tuned for the next exciting episode of FanCheck.